Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I am the founder of Project MedTech, Dwayne Mancini. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review, and you can always visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, or follow us on LinkedIn. This is another episode of Project MedTech's series, MedTech Money. This is a special series by Project MedTech where we have partnered with Mr. MedTech himself, Giovanni Loricella, in a series of podcast episodes focusing on money in the MedTech space. Giovanni's guest today is Eyal Lifshitz from Peregrine Ventures. In this episode, Giovanni and Eyal discuss the fascinating reason why they chose the name Peregrine Ventures, his history in the medtech space, where their various funds invest in the life cycle of a medtech company, comparing Israel to the other health science startup hubs, the future of Israel and how it'll center around manufacturing technology, and so much more. So without further ado, Giovanni's discussion with Eyal Lifshitz.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Hey, Al, thank you very much for being here. I'm very excited about today's podcast because I have a strong connection, at least personally, with Israel. And today we're going to highlight Israel coming from a VC perspective. So thank you for being on here. And this is the MedTech Money podcast series powered by Project MedTech and sponsored by Lifeblood Capital. So I want to introduce this podcast. Those of us who have been following it for quite some time, thank you for listening and staying with us. For those joining for the first time, here we are. I've talked to thousands of medtech entrepreneurs and investors around the world, and I've discovered that there's no silver bullet or specific formula about how to raise or invest capital in medtech. So my goal of this podcast is I'd like to extract insights, anecdotal stories, and get them from investment bankers, entrepreneurs who are raising capital, and Eyal, from investors like yourself. So to help these stories are going to benefit all the information that we're gathering on these podcasts for hopefully generations to come. And the audience listening in today is likely a mixture of experts and novices. And I wanted to extract your stories, insights, and advice so that we can share with what I imagine is that first-time founder or CEO and has no clue of what lies ahead of them on their journey of raising capital, especially highlighting the aspect of Israel. So we'll get to that. And I thought the best place to start is from learning from experienced professionals like yourself. So as I alluded to, the reason why we're here today is I want to highlight Peregrine Ventures. I want to understand what you guys are doing on the early stage investment side, the later stage investment side, and more importantly, in general, what does this venture scene look like in Israel and how are they playing on a global scale? So let's start off with a few questions to engage the audience. First one for you, Eyal, is do you believe that people and money are the lifeblood of a medtech startup? Why or why not? Or would you add anything that else that's also important?
Yes, I think... First of all, thank you very much, Giovanni, for having me here. It's a great pleasure. And I really look forward to this session with you and to have this discussion with you, which I'm sure that I will learn a lot from. So it's a very important question. And I think, first of all, technology is always about people. And technology was always the ladder from which economies and social groups could go and improve their situation to what they were before, also on the financial side. But there is a very special aspect to our industry, to the life science industry, which is a part of the high-tech scene. Here in Israel, I chair the Israeli Seed Investors Association, which it's all venture capital, technology incubators, and 700-something companies. And then when we meet and we have the tech funds, they talk about tech and then they go, okay, so what's going on in the medtech space? They like put it as a different part of away from the regular tech scene. And I see it different. I think that people, especially on the medical devicing and on digital health, which we see, it's an important part of the tech scene. But if you look on the people there, I mean, not that in other spaces you don't have excellent people, of course you do, but there is something special about the life science high-tech scene, which, yes, of course, it's very much about money. But it's, if you could be an entrepreneur who goes into the cyber space, or you go to a life science, and very often the one that goes and takes his technology towards life sciences has a story. It can be someone in the family that was sick. It can be his own fears of being sick. But there's very often there's a story there, and you will find very often, not rare at all, entrepreneurs and CEOs really came to change things. And I think this makes our industry very special. You see it also on the pharma side, but you mainly see it on the medical devices and the medical software, which they're really the entrepreneurs. They could, if it's an engineer, he could have gone any place else. He didn't have to go into medical devices or in software. He could have gone into anywhere else. He didn't have to go to digital health. So people that did choose to go over there, very often they come with something very important which they want to leave behind them. And I think this makes our industry very special.
If you knew what you know now about being a medtech investor, and we'll get into your background, you have a long history of operations, entrepreneurship, et cetera, that led you to where you are today as a medtech investor, life science investor. Would you do it all over again? Why or why not? Or what would you do differently if you could?
Wow, that's a big one. I am very lucky. I go to work and I enjoy what I do. And I do it now for many years, and I still enjoy it a lot. If I look back on the technologies that came in, that we helped bring to the market together with amazing entrepreneurs and amazing teams and amazing doctors, that we had the privilege to be a small part of bringing them to the market. And I think about all these people that cancer patients that improved, had a good quality of life and lived a good life, on patients with heart failure or with diabetes that live a good life, all due to technology. I love it. And it's so interesting. And there's every time there's something new. It's unbelievable. Also in spaces which sometimes you really think that you saw everything, and then comes the 20 something year young engineer, and he just comes with something and you say, wow, how did he think about it? How did this never come before? And it is amazing. It is amazing. You have, and the tough moments also, sometimes things don't work the way that we would hope. And yes, and there are tough moments. But at the end, I really love what I do. I think I'm privileged to be where I am and to do what I do. I really enjoy. And my very clear answer to you is absolutely yes. But I feel that I'm lucky.
And you started Peregrine Ventures. We'll learn what that is shortly. Mm-hmm. But the name, Peregrine Ventures, what does the name of your company mean? Why did you choose that name?
So this goes back to where I was a child. And I was always fascinated by animals, nature, and especially by birds. And since I was a little baby, I always looked at birds. I was fascinated. I was looking for them in the sky. Then when I grew, I looked a lot of birds and prey. And the birds of prey, you have the eagles and you have the hawk, which they're all amazing. But the smallest family there is the falcons. And within the, which they're very small, but they're extremely fast. They fly high up into the sky. And if you see a peregrine is the fastest falcon, and is the fastest animal in the world. It's over 300 kilometers per hour. That's 170 miles, something like this, per hour, a bit more. In a stoop, if you see a peregrine, and peregrine and all birds of prey, the males are about a third smaller than the females, which gives them a good variety to hunt and to supply the chicks with different sources of food, this big difference in sizes. So, but when the male tries to go after the same quarry which the female goes, and sometimes he tries, then he knows because he's so much smaller, he has to go much higher up. And if a male, when he goes up and prepares himself to a stoop, he goes up and up and up until he's a dot in the sky. You can hardly see him. And then he comes, and then he decides where he wants to go. He can stay in the air for some time. But then when he comes down, the speed is just amazing. And the way that he's able to control his flight in this speed, and the way that he's able to see. Can you imagine to see in such a speed? If I open the window to my car, if I'm driving fast, it's hard to look outside. If I wouldn't have the glass in front of me, it would have been completely impossible. And they can still see. They can still see. And then when there's an impact and when they catch something, if I would take my hand out from a train and touch something, my hand will break into pieces. And they can hit something in such a speed and nothing comes to it. There's enormous biomimicry there, which is extremely interesting, but it's just a fascinating animal, and just being close to it and being able to how it takes decisions and how it maneuvers is just amazing. So I learned falconry. I learned falconry not because I'm interested in the hunting part. I went to the Scottish Academy of Falconry in Scotland, and I made two long courses. And I'm very much involved here in Israel and around the world in different projects of releasing back birds of prey to the wild, which you have to teach the birds that grow in captivity how to fly, because in nature, mother and father do it. And then when this has to be done here in Israel, there's a lot of activity in that space of releasing back birds of prey back to nature. And when they have to be taught how to fly, then they call me, and together with a group of very dedicated friends, we help them and teach them how to fly. So this is where the name Peregrine came.
I love asking that question to any guest, and I usually preface with the fact that sometimes the names are very straightforward, so maybe the story is quite short and very obvious. And other times there's these names where, okay, there's got to be something behind it. I'm so glad I asked you that question, because that was an incredible story. So I learned a lot about you, but also the reason and purpose and the imagery behind what's going on behind Peregrine Ventures. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. For everyone listening in right now, we've heard Eyal's voice. Let's introduce him, Eyal Lifshitz. This is the co-founder and general managing partner of Peregrine Ventures. Who are you? Where do you come from? How did you build your career to where you are now? You told us that you had a stop off in Scotland, which is very interesting, but give us this man behind the voice right now so that we understand who we're listening to as we move forward, both from a personal and professional perspective, as much as you can share.
So, so I started my career in the early 90s. Started my career. While I was in university, I had a business, and I was introduced by my accountant to two excellent engineers, which we started a pump technology. And my father, who comes from the pharma industry in Switzerland, I was born and grew up in Switzerland, said that this technology, which these two engineers came up with, which was a very small and accurate pump, could be a very interesting IV pump. And then we developed an intravenous, very accurate pump, which was worn as a watch, which we were controlling the different gas pressures very accurately. And it was a patient-controlled analgesic pump that we came to the market, and we got FDA approval in 94. After getting FDA approval, we went to take it public on NASDAQ. And during the roadshow to take the company public, Elan Pharmaceuticals which was at the time was the biggest drug delivery company in capsule. They did encapsulations, different sorts of drugs. Their big competitor at the time bought an IV pump technology, and they approached us, and then during the roadshow, we started discussions, and the initial short meeting took a few days, and we sold them the whole company. This was in 94. Then they started Elan Medical Technologies here in Israel, in which we did everything which was not encapsulation of a chemical encapsulation of a drug. So this was iontophoretic patches and small pumps and capsules which released drugs, inhalators, complicated inhalators that we tried to take polypeptides through the lungs. Everything which was not encapsulation we did here. Actually, Elan Medical Technologies, it was still a few years. It was here at the same place in Yavne here in Israel. I had the contract there for 2 years. I stayed there for almost 3 years, and then I left with another technology that we started to incorporate into the patches. It was an electrochemical, today we call it a capacitor, then we called it a sort of a battery, which we took out from the Weizmann Institute because we needed, for these active patches, we needed a special power source. And I left with that technology and started another company and sold that and sold, and then started three more, sold another two out of them. So in total, started five companies, sold four out of them. And in 2001, my brother and I, we started Peregrine, which we continue to work the same way that we work all the time through the 90s. And this is until today, this is really in the DNA of our funds. Is that we are in regular contact with the big players in the space, with the Johnsons, with the Medtronics, with the Bristol Myers, with the Boston Scientifics. We meet them four or five times a year now during COVID. Of course, it's by Zoom. Each of them have a few portfolio companies that they follow. We update them on what is happening in those portfolio companies, especially before important clinical trials. We share with them the protocol. They come back to us and say that they would like to add this or add that. And according to this, we change the protocols. Then after those trials, we come back to them with the results. And then during those meetings, sometimes they will decide to invest in companies or buy companies, which is part of our exits were done that way. But most important, we discuss together with them what they look for in a year, 3, 5, 7, or 10 from now. And according to that, we invest in technologies or help technologies or ideas get off the ground. So that's really how we work till today. we started in April 15, 2001. We started our first fund, which was the first pure life science designated fund here in the country. We have very good funds who invested in life science before, but they did also other investments. They invested in communication, in software, and clean tech. And life sciences, and so we started then this designated fund, which then looked a bit strange.
So jump in real quick and qualify that. So you're saying Peregrine Ventures was the first venture capital firm in Israel solely dedicated to the life science industry?
Yeah.
And when you say life sciences, are you bifurcating or separating out medical devices from that, or are you including that in there? Is it biopharma and medical device life sciences?
Yes, it's biopharma, medical devices, and medical software, digital health, or you can give it different names. Yes, we do all the three sectors.
And I'm sure you were leading on to that. So now that we know who you are, if we can start wrapping around the story and prop up what Peregrine Ventures is, right? So we now know it's the first dedicated life science medical device venture capital firm in Israel. Mm-hmm. Today, or even the story behind it, how do you invest? What do you invest in? Where do you invest? Minimum size ticket, size of funds, for example, how many funds have you done? Just tell the story of Peregrine to date.
Sure. So in April 15, 2001, we started Peregrine One. We now invest, we are towards the end of investing from Peregrine Four. Peregrine 1, 2, 3, and 4, we invest early stage mid-stage, sometimes a little bit later, but not at the very last, at the very late stage, the crossover, the last round before IPOs or before M&A. For this, we started now a designated fund, which is a crossover fund, the classic crossover. So this fund invests before M&As or before IPOs in life science companies. What we did until now is that when we invested in the company very early, and we continue to invest in it mid-stage and a little bit later on, or sometimes we started mid-stage, when it came to a crossover fund, then we came to our LPs and offered them to invest at the very last round of those companies, which they did very often, over 30 times. But at some point, they actually came to us and said, look, why don't you, instead of every time coming to us and we have to go through our investment committee, and if it's an insurance company, for example, then it's a complex procedure to go through investment committee. Why don't you just do a very late stage designated fund? And you will invest there. Those same companies which you either invested before, in most cases, companies which you follow anyways, because anything which goes on in the world, in oncology, in those areas which we're interested in, and we'll talk about it in a minute, is of interest to us, and we follow it anyway for years. So why don't you now build a designated tool and invest at those very late stages, which we start with, and this is what we did. End of last year, we launched this fund from which we invest in very late stage opportunities. Ticket-wise, there I think our biggest investment was a bit over $26 million per round at a single round. We can put up to $30 million check size in those very late stage rounds. That for Peregrine Growth. Peregrine 1, 2, 3, and 4, we invest, I would say, total up to $11, $12 million per company total. And this is in most cases in 2-3 rounds. But we can invest also a much, much smaller check. It can be as little as $10,000 just to write an initial patent just to begin with, and which we do very often. But I would say the normal A round would be something around $2 million, something in that. But we do have before the A round, what we call the A round, is we have a technology incubator. And in this technology incubator, we put in, if someone comes with a beautiful idea, but it's very early, it's just, there's just an idea, there's just a patent or almost a patent. Sometimes we've written think together how to write the first patents, but there's just an idea, there's no team at all. Now this company needs a year or two or three really to work on the concept. For this, we have our technology incubator. And in the technology incubator, we put an idea, which in most cases, just someone who came up with this idea. So again, so for example, if Medtronic told us, for example, look how to solve pulmonary edema, a new sensor for pulmonary edema without an implant, for example. Then we looked for a lot of technologies. We searched more than a year, and then an idea came up, but it was just an idea. So just something sound, analyzing sound. So we put this in the technology incubator, and it took really a year to work on the concept, and then another year to recruit a team that really knew what they're doing. So it wasn't a real company during those 2 years. Now, what is very special at that stage here in Israel is that if you are an early stage investor and you have the experience, you have the team, and you prove the Ministry of Trade function within the Ministry of Trade, which is called the Chief Scientist, that you know what you're doing, you can ask for a license for a technology incubator, a partnership between the private sector, as we are, and the government. And then you get a license. It was initially for 6 years, 8 years, now it's back to 6 years. And then when we put in a technology into the technology incubator, for every dollar that we put in, we get $5.6 as a grant from the Israeli government, which is huge, because now you can really, you don't have, if there's a crazy idea and you want to work on it, if you come to, even if you come to your investment committee and you say, look, I have this idea and maybe we'll stop playing around with the mitral valve and let's see what happens. You can't take it to investment committee. You can't. But here, the risk, the financial risk is so low. There's a lot of work in every company that you start, a lot of work. But the financial risk is very low. So this is a tool which is very unique here in Israel. It's and it proved to be extremely, extremely successful. Amazing companies were born like that in our portfolio and in others also. Interestingly enough, it started, this whole idea of technology incubator started it in the 80s. In the 80s, there were about 6 million people here in Israel. And at once, after Perestroika, the Russian gates opened and Jews were allowed to leave Russia, which they weren't allowed. And then we had, during a period of less than 2 years, more than 1 million people came into Israel. Can you imagine a country with 6 million people bringing in 1 million? That's how much this is, as if now to the States within a year and a half, you would have something like 50 million people coming in. That's a lot. Now you have to absorb them. And people came, the professors with amazing knowledge came and so the company, I mean, the bigger companies tried to absorb as much as they could and the academy as much as they could, but it was just so much. And then you had literally professors that were cleaning the streets in order to make a living. And then the government made this extremely clever strategy of coming to those people, everybody that has an idea, it doesn't matter in what area ever, it can be in metal, in metallurgy, it can be in software, it can be in whatever, clean tech. And you have an interesting idea, come to us, we'll give you a lab for 2 years, we'll give you a salary, you can take 2 or 3 assistants and work together with them and take this technology, this amazing knowledge, which came out from the Russian bloc, and let's try to do something with it. And so really amazing companies came out of that, and which was very much one of the reasons to what we call here in Israel the technology boom. From outside, they call it Startup Nation. It's one of the reasons that really made this possible, was this amazing, amazing river of knowledge and new areas of interest that came from Russia during those years. And technology incubators was a very important part of that. And then those technology incubators, they were doing the 80s and the 90s, and then at the beginning of the 2000s, they became obsolete because those Russian immigrants, they were absorbed into the Israeli academy and economy. And then these technology incubators were privatized, and Carmel Vernia was then the chief scientist, thought about how to privatize them, and then these were privatized, and then it really started as a cooperation between the government and the private sector. And since then it continues and flourishes, and especially interesting during very tough times, like after 2008, after 2001 also, I mean, 2000, when it started really in 2002-03, but then after 2008, 2009, 10 were the toughest years for an entrepreneur really to start a company. You could at that time you could invest in a company which was 5-6 year old in valuations which were close to zero all over the world, by the way, in the States, in Europe, here in Israel, But what happened, so no one really started companies during 2008, 9, 10, no one really started companies because there was just no point in investing in an early stage company while you could invest on the same close to zero valuation in a company which was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. So Europe stopped starting founding companies, and there was very little going on in Europe during those years. There were some places which still things happened. There was around Geneva, there was physics on the accelerator, there were still interesting things going on, but it was actually, most of it was actually really only there. The rest of Europe, companies didn't really start, which had a huge impact on the technology sector, on venture capital sector in Europe the years after that. In Israel, because of this chief scientist concept of technology incubator and partnership with the private industry, every year they had the same amount of companies started. So it was around 80 companies every year started, high quality companies during 2008, 9, 10, at least 80 companies. I think in 2008 it was 80 companies. The years after that it was a bit over 100. But these are not enormous numbers, but it's still a core. Still companies really starting. Still investors investing in a company which is now 1 or 2 years old in 2010, which you didn't have in other places. And so that's an extremely thoughtful and important move, which actually the government did here, which turned out to have an extremely positive impact on the industry in general.
So you brought up this word or name, Startup Nation, and I want to dig into it. And I'll tell you my very abridged short story of this one. So over 10 years ago, I came across Startup Nation, this book, The Economic Miracle of Israel. And I always had a fascination with Israel and had yet not been there. And I've been to Israel now many, many times. And so I opened it up and I was in Starbucks and I got there with my morning coffee and I finished the book cover to cover in one day at a Saturday in Starbucks. And there was a section of it that talked about medical devices. And in there, they alluded to this company called Beta O2. And there was this other gentleman who was constantly referenced, Yossi Gross. And I was enamored and I had to go to Israel and I had to understand what Israel was all about. Make a long story short, a few months later was my first time to Israel. And I had sent emails and I had somehow found his number and I called and I called and I called Yossi. And I never heard back from him until one day I finally get this call and it's this raspy Israeli voice and it goes, "I've got all these emails and calls from you. I'm calling for Giovanni." And I said, "Who is this?" He goes, "It's Yossi Gross." And I go, "Oh my God. Okay. Well, I'm heading to Israel. I'd love to meet you." And it ended up turning into a story where, and I know that you're very well aware of him with your affiliation with your companies. I was introduced to Yossi's son, Amir Gross, who's now a very successful entrepreneur. On that trip, my very first trip, I ended up finding out who the CEO of the time was, which was Zohar Gendler from Beta O2. And my first trip to Israel from this book, I ended up renting a car and I drove out and I got lost. I couldn't tell you how many times, but finally met Zohar and he gave me the tour of Beta O2 and the clean room. And I got to hold the device in my hand. And then I got to meet Yossi. And then he introduced me to his son, Amir, through Tal Reich, who is the former COO of Valtech Cardio. And so it was this amazing experience. And I finally had opened up this imagery that I got from the book and it was real. It was right in front of me. It was Israel. It was a Startup Nation. And not only that, then I started driving to the north and to the south and I've been everywhere. And I absolutely am still to this day, very enamored with Israel. So that's my story to the question. You've given all these historical, political, as well as geographical reasons of what Israel is today. But this concept of Startup Nation, and it continues to persist, is it more than a million Russians coming to Israel? Is it more than this ability for having the private and the governmental sectors working together? Is there like a spirit within Israel that just makes it a unique place more so than others when it comes to innovation, from your perspective?
So first of all, I have to say you touched here on some of the names which are really the core of our industry here. And Yossi Gross, when I told you my initial career as an entrepreneur, this very first company, the pump company, pharmacist, was of course together with Yossi Gross and Shlomo Zucker, were the two engineers and some others. And out of the five companies that that I was a co-founder before starting Peregrine, four were together with Yossi. And he's an outstanding phenomenon, not just an outstanding human being, the smartest, the nicest, the gracious man. I think he has well over 1,000 patents on his name, which I don't know. I didn't really check it out, but I don't think there are many people in the world ever that have so many ideas. Yossi has a special deep understanding of the human body, how it really works. It's when we look at nature, we look at it different than Yossi. Yossi really understands it in the deepest possible sense of the world, of really understanding the mechanism of a complex human or any natural interaction between muscles and nerves and bones and chemistry and biology and genetics. Yossi is really special. His son Amir is, I know Amir since he's a little kid. By the way, he was the babysitter of my Falcons. He always says this was the first big money which he ever did when I had to travel. He took care of my Falcons. So we just live very close to each other. He was a little kid, but he was amazing then. You mentioned Zohar Gendler and Tal Reich. They are amazing CEOs and entrepreneurs and CTOs. So yes, there's some amazing people here. But going back to your basic question, what this really is, Startup Nation. So it's a combination of things which everyone that you speak with here in Israel that went through and saw the industry growing the last 30 years, we give you a little bit of a different angle. I think it's a combination. It's a combination, first of all, of Israel being an island. Being an island and had to rely in the 50s and 60s, really before this very special relationship with the US started, Israel really had to rely on itself, was an island here in this crazy part of the world, and had to have all industries done by themselves, including the army industries, which for such a small nation, you need a lot of disciplines. So you have places in which people are very good in cellular, okay? In Denmark, you had Ericsson and Nokia, and you had a big company in cellular that were just made, but here it was not enough. You needed cellular, and you needed software, and you needed hardware, and you needed really everything, metals. You really needed everything. So in not all disciplines, you could have been really the best, but at the end, you needed the best technology. So what we here really excel is in working together in different disciplines. Whenever there's something which is multidisciplinary, inherently, you will see that companies that do it here in Israel do it much faster and with a much smaller budget than in other places of the world, which is very unique. You will have people that were together in the university or in the army. They know each other. He knows metals. He knows software. Okay, now we can do a medical robot, which needs metal and software and plastic. You will find that. And there's very strong academy and tradition-wise, the from the old days, for more than 2,000 years, people learn the Talmud. Learning the Talmud is really learning from one thing to the other and appreciating learning. And Jews were never really very strong or athletes or, but there was a lot of emphasis. Every child needed to learn. Every child needed to read. Every boy, every girl, always needed to learn how to read. And this is maybe also an important part out of that. This is also why we have very strong universities there in Israel, which is an important part of that. We have very good hospitals here in Israel. Actually, Tel HaShomer, which is one of the biggest hospitals here in the country, by Newsweek was elected as one of the 10 best hospitals in the world. So it's a combination between that. I think there's also people here, and this is in the last 40 years, I would say, go and learn in the best universities, mainly in the States, but also in Europe, and they come back with a lot of knowledge. And there's just a lot of cooperation because, again, we are a small country, we have to cooperate. And we cooperate, of course, with academy and companies in the States, but all over the world, which is also a part of the tradition. Jews were used to have family far away and move. Sometimes they had to move. So they always had connections. And maybe it's a part of our tradition. So I gave you a very long answer to a very short question, is because as a matter of fact, we don't really have a clear answer. I think it's the combination between all of that. And all of this now, and now with a few decades of companies that started and companies which were sold outside, Tal Reich, for example, he's just amazing. At Valtech, he was just amazing. But now he works for the buyer of Valtech, which is a very big American company. And now he learned how you have to work in a big company, corporate America. And then he will come back, I'm sure, one day to another startup, but now he'll have much more experience. And he will know not only how to be very fast and quick in his R&D like an Israeli, but now he will also know how to see the bigger picture as he saw from this big corporate. So we learn. By the way, we have a lot of competition, of course, especially from the Boston Strip and the Silicon Valley, and which is fine. I think if you look on the Israeli phenomena of Startup Nation, then you also have to look what is happening in Boston and what is happening in Silicon Valley. But in the last decade, you also have to look at what is happening in New York, which is amazing, especially on the life science side. If you look on this, we in the past and in the early 2000s, we always looked at Europe and then the States. So today it's really the Boston Valley in life sciences. It's the Boston Valley. It's the Silicon. It's the Boston Strip. It's the Silicon Valley, and it's Israel. Very interesting what happened to Europe. There's still interesting things which are happening in Europe, but if you look for different parameters like numbers of unicorns. Unicorn is a company which is worth more than $1 billion. So numbers of unicorns in Israel, there are more unicorns than in all of Europe combined together with England. So something that changed it, while there were a lot of startups, they're much less since 2008, there's so much less. I'm sure that they will catch up and come back, but just the numbers, it's very interesting. It's very interesting to look at. Now, still, we have a lot of things to learn here. For example, what we improved a little bit in the last few years, but still a lot of work to do, is in manufacturing. Quality in massive manufacturing of technology, of high technology devices, things which have to be very accurate. Still in Israel, there's not enough tradition for manufacturing. Now, it started in the last few years, but here we have a lot to learn from our friends in Europe, from our friends in the States, from our friends in Japan, of how to manufacture good quality, be steady, and have good quality in manufacturing, which it's very much against the nature of being very quick in R&D and finding a quick solution, solving it. In manufacturing, it doesn't work. That's exactly what you don't want in manufacturing. In manufacturing, you want quality control to be very accurate step by step. So that's something which we work on a lot, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. So so this is what we work now. Interesting enough, if you would have spoken 15 years ago, I would have told you that in life sciences, we still miss management with good experience, which we missed really 15 years ago. But now again, because there were so many companies sold, as I said before, that were sold to American companies or companies in other places of the world, and those entrepreneurs, founders, CEOs came back. And so today we have top management here in the country. And while an Israeli company would have gone public on Nasdaq, for example, 15 years ago, in most cases, you would bring in another CEO, in most cases, an American CEO, which today is not the case. Today you can leave management because they're so experienced and they're good. So a lot of things which we're improving slowly, but there are things also which there's still a lot of room for improvement, mainly in manufacturing. And if we talk here in Israel, because the high-tech scene became so important for the Israeli economy, and what we try here really to do is to have more and more people here in Israel enjoying the high-tech scene. Now, but not everyone is a doctor, not everyone is an engineer, not everybody is a software expert. You really want to, in order to have much more people enjoying this technology sector, you need to bring in manufacturing, because then you can bring also people who have less of academical background, to bring her into the manufacturing part of those technologies and improve their financial situations, and then you can bring in a lot of people. In order to do that, we need to improve the way of quality control, the way that we look on quality validation, verifications. That's something which really we have to do. This is something which we work on, but as we will succeed to do that, this would really be the next step to bring in substantial manufacturing of technology here in Israel. And really manufacturing of technology, if you manufacture something, a valve, for example, for the heart or an arm for a robot, then if it costs now $2 to manufacture or $4 to manufacture, it doesn't really matter, because anyway, you sell it at $200. So you don't have to go for that to places which are very cheap to manufacture today, but you can leave manufacturing here, like countries in Europe try to do, bring in. So to manufacture goods which have high margins, this is really what you want to leave inside of Europe. You want to leave it inside of the States, but we also want to leave here and not to bring it out. But this is in order to get there, we really have to improve the way that we manufacture in big scale, and we work on it.
So I like to know that that's the future of Israel. And certainly for those listening right now, a big highlight. So we now know about Startup Nation, certainly an innovation ecosystem. Manufacturing, next chapter. You started Peregrine Ventures April 15th, 2001. We've been very centric on Israel, but you started alluding to the Boston Strip, Silicon Valley, what's happening in Europe, manufacturing over in Japan. We live in a very big world, and Israel, a huge powerhouse in innovation, yet very small. Mm-hmm. Peregrine 1, 2, 3, 4, and now mm-hmm. Peregrine Growth. Mm-hmm. Even though you were the first Israeli life science venture capital fund dedicated to that industry, do you invest outside of Israel, or is it 100% mm-hmm. Israeli focused? Talk about that. Mm-hmm. How does Peregrine mm-hmm. Ventures play within mm-hmm. the Israeli venture capital ecosystem mm-hmm. within life sciences, mm-hmm. but how does mm-hmm. it also play on the international scale?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So I would divide it into two. First of all, areas again which are of interest for us and in pharma, it's mainly oncology. And in oncology, it's the newest areas, immune oncology, novel targeted therapies, cell-based therapies, cytokine therapies, gene therapy. We follow everything which is happening anywhere. It can be in Israel, it can be in Boston, it can be in Holland, it can be in Switzerland. We follow everything. Medical devices, cardiovascular, diabetes, robotics, we follow everything. So, but the thing is, if you invest early stages when, and as a seed investors, if you invest in an idea, which there's no team, there's no clear concept what the product has to do, there's no plan yet for clinical trials, but also preclinical trials. If you really want to invest at that stage, you have to be with the company, not once a month, every day. You really have to be there. And our seed companies, they're within all of them, 100% of them are within our facilities. Sorry, all the companies in Israel are within our facilities. Because we sit with them every day on okay, so what are you working now on the R&D, on the clinical trials, on how do you recruit the team? Because in a year or two, you have to be a company. You need a team. So there's a lot of working together with the entrepreneur, with the founder, to take this idea and create a company out of this idea. So, and in order to do that, you really have to be there. So here in Israel, we invest only in companies all of the companies which invest in are within our facilities. Very rarely, we invest early stage outside of Israel. But this is when we have someone else that we know that he can do the same work. It's very rare. We did it a few times in the States together with partners there, which were also seed investors. And those companies were, again, they were very close to them. They saw them every day or almost every day and did the same. So really in order for seed investments, pre-A rounds, it has to be within your facility. And this is why then we really invest almost over all of our investments here in Israel. When we invest at the later stage, especially at the crossover before IPO or before M&A, the company can be everywhere because those companies are now before M&A, before IPO. They have, of course, they have a team, they have everything, they have a strategy, they have everything. And then for us, there's no difference. It doesn't matter really where they are, and they can be here or they can be on the Boston Strip. And at that stage, we invest all over the world. And we invest either alone or together with local funds, or sometimes using other Israeli funds which will co-invest with us, or strategic partners that will co-invest. But when we talk about the very late stage investment, so it really doesn't matter where the company is. It's more important that this is really the best in class in that space, and then it doesn't matter where it is.
So I've heard this many times about the proximity or being so close, especially on seed funding or even early stage ventures in general, that the investor wants to be as close as possible. I've never flushed it out perfectly. Hopefully you can help me out with that. So it's very clear, with the exception of the few times on the seed side where you have invested outside, but it was with other partners who you trusted very much so, and they were still very close to the investments. Mm-hmm. All of your other seed investments in early stage have been tangible, even in your facilities, like you mentioned. Yes. Now you have this growth stage fund that you can invest literally anywhere around the world. What is that psychological or financial difference? Like, why do you need to handhold your startup so early on seed and maybe Series A, we'll call it, just early stage stuff? And why is it okay for you to sit in your office in Israel and invest in a crossover round in Boston or Australia or in England or in Silicon Valley? What's the difference? Why? Why can you do that without having to handhold every single day with those companies?
Yeah, that's a very important question. When we invest in a crossover round, then there's a whole list of criteria. What is a crossover round, really? And I'm sure, again, everybody will give you a little bit of a different definition. For us, the definition is, will the company within this money, which they raise now in this round, have a reasonable chance to get to an exit? And an exit can be either via an M&A or IPO. So then when there's a candidate for Peregrine Growth, then we discuss together with the companies, we discuss, okay, now explain us why can this be a candidate now for Peregrine Growth? And then they say, yes, we are already in discussions with strategic. And then we go and we speak with the strategics, and we really want to hear from them. Yes, we know this and this company. Yes, we are in contact with them. We have discussions with them. This is where we are. And this is what is still missing. And this is what maybe still has to be done. But we understand that within the next 18 and up to 24 months, and that's about the round of financing, which is suffices the money for, this company will be bought. And with strategics, we always check it with more than one, because we don't want to invest something only for company X, which goes along. And then when a company is working towards an IPO, then we speak with analysts and underwriters, like, this is company so-and-so, and what do you think? This is a company which now could be a candidate for an IPO within the next year or two. And we only after we hear from them, then we invest in that. Now, in order for a company to be ripe for an IPO or to be ripe for an M&A, you need the product to be well-defined, regulatory to be already well-advanced, and you need management, because no one will buy a company if there's no management. If there won't be Tal Reich or Amir Gross in the company, then forget it. Then it won't be bought. And it also can't go public. Now, and Amir Gross, I don't have to hand his hold every day. He knows exactly what he's doing. You know what? He can teach me. So I don't have to babysit him. By the way, at the beginning when he started, him in particular, when he started, when he was the freshman, he just came out of law school. But at the beginning, when Valtech started, he was the CEO of Valtech from day one. He was at the incubator. And at the incubator, this was still a stage in which really everything we did together, and there was a lot of work which me and my team did. But at the end, now, he can teach everyone. Now, by the way, Valtech and now CardioValve, which is 2 minutes walking distance from where I sit. We're still very close. Now, because when someone, and this is most of our also advanced companies, which don't have to be, which are not at the incubator stage at all, they still are around here, either in this building here or maximum two minutes walking distance from here. Because it also became, I don't know, that when someone from Medtronic comes and he comes to see Amir, then he knows that the same day he can see another four or five companies, and in 2-3 hours he can cover here five, six companies which are of prime interest for him. So now Amir also knows, now if a banker comes or, I don't know, a venture capital comes to one another company, because he's so close, that he will also come and see him. So there's a lot of interaction. If a CEO here needs, he's wondering, he's looking for a subcontractor, he can speak with other CEOs. They go together for lunch, or if they look to recruit people. So there's a lot of interaction. That's also something which you have here in the Israeli high tech scene. It's very small, very condensed. And it turned out, so in the last few years here, this area in Or Yehuda became the capital of the medical device industry here in the country. So there are a lot of there's a lot of interaction between the company. But when a company is very early, you really have to help the company to work on its strategy, to work on its development, to find the right subcontractors to work with, to go into the right hospitals to do the clinical trials. When a company is very advanced, like at the growth stage, they really know what they're doing, and then they can be anywhere in the world.
So it's much more, it's kind of like, hopefully this is not a terrible analogy, but it's like building a house, right? I mean, and you're going to do the work yourself, or at least painting the room. You have to invest your money, but you're also doing a lot of the physical work in the seed stage. You're very close to what you're actually putting the money in, even though it's your investment. Mm-hmm. You're living in the house, mm-hmm. and you're doing a lot of the work. Mm-hmm. When you're investing in a stock that you look and your best friend calls you up and he says, hey, I have the stock tip for you. I know about this company, not insider trading, but this is going to take off. And if you throw in $1,000, I guarantee in 6 months, it's going to be $3,000, whatever it may be. You don't really do any work. You just trust in the fact that it's going to, I mean, is that something similar to this where you know that you're trusting in the management team, you trust in the strategy, obviously you're validating the fact that it's very late stages and there's a high likelihood of an exit where you're like, listen, it's a beautiful package. I heard good things. It makes a lot of sense. Here's my money. Meanwhile, on the seed side, you're the one that's painting the walls and helping everything with all that little money that you put in. Something like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would just add to that one little touch that also on the very late stage opportunities, you have on the strategy of how to sell the company, how to take the company public, but many how to sell the company. The process of selling a company can take easily a year, and it has to be very well structured. You start, in most cases, you start with an auction, and then you decide who you're working with, and then you build the deal, and very often it's a milestone-based deal. So there's a lot of work that you have to do together with management. You have to be very in sync with them. So also our companies that we invest in at the late stage and they're far away, it's not that we don't speak with them. We speak to them very often. We work with them on the strategy, on the business development of how to get to an exit. We work with them very intensively. This can be done by Zoom like now. But in an early stage company, you really have to look on the device together. And now if something comes and it doesn't work, now you really have to understand why. Or for an early stage company in the incubator, you really want the team to be focused on what they do. You don't want them to be about bookkeeping and take care of things and ordering lunch. You don't want them to be busy with that. You want them only really to be busy with what they want to do, and this is to develop. So we have in our technology incubator, we take care of all this black work. We take care. We have bookkeepers who make for them all the bookkeeping. They don't have to take care of that at all. It's being taken care of. They can really focus on what they do, and in order to be there, they have to sign together on every check every day. So it's you really have to be there. But on the late stage, it's much less about that. There is a lot of work on strategy, on how to bring the company to an exit, and this we can do also from far. It's not the same physical proximity that you need for at an early stage company.
I'm sensitive to time. I know you have a board meeting coming up here. I do want to sign off with this one question. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you and I could be on this call and do a podcast for 2 days straight without sleeping. We have a lot to talk about, and you're an amazing, incredible storyteller. So thank you for everything you've shared today. My last question that I just want the audience to learn and have an understanding, geographically speaking, what is the venture capital ecosystem look like? When it comes specifically, let's talk about medtech. I know biotech is very big and biopharma is very big. If we talk about medtech, what is the ecosystem of being an Israeli venture capitalist look like in Israel? Is there a lot of competition? Is it all going to software at this point? Is it all going to the cardio valves and the heart valve companies of the world in Israel right now? Or I should say heart valve companies of Israel right now. What is it like being a venture capitalist dedicated to medtech in Israel? Are there a bunch of you? Are there few of you? Are you constantly competing in the world? What does it look like?
I think it's very similar to venture capitals in the States. Again, and much more similar to venture capital in the States than venture capitals in Europe, because we spoke before about the big difference between Europe and Israel and the States. So yes, first of all, we have competition here, and I'm afraid to say they're very good. They're very good competitors, and they're smart, and they're very experienced, and they have beautiful portfolios, and we compete, and we try to get to the best deals, to the deals that we like. But so sometimes we compete, but most of our companies are companies which we really initiated or helped to initiate after we had those discussions with the strategics. So at the seed stage, we have less competition because we see those companies, the vast majority of our portfolio. But there are other very good funds here in the country. And just to mention a few, there's Pontifex, and there's Amon, and there's IBF, and then there's Tri Ventures, and some very good funds. Very experienced funds. But you also see here the deal fields and the USVPs. You will see them here also competing on deals. So I would say this is, so you have the Israeli funds, you have the American funds, and then you have the strategics who also they're here. The Israel is not a secret for them. For Medtronic and Johnson, they have the venture arm and they have the local people here, and they look for deals and they compete. And sometimes we compete and sometimes we co-invest. Very often, actually, we co-invest, but sometimes we compete. And it's like exactly like you see in the States. And the same is there. Sometimes there we compete and sometimes we co-invest. And this is absolutely okay. We have very good friends with our colleagues in the States, in Europe, Far East, in Israel. We co-invest a lot. But sometimes, yes, there's a very healthy competition. I think it's very important to, I'm very glad that I have here competitors which sometimes are much faster, smarter than we. Keeps us on our toes, and we have to continue to improve together with them. And it's a part of also an industry becoming mature. And it's absolutely good for the industry. I have to say that we are very good friends also with our colleagues or competitors, but that's absolutely fine.
So signing off, I want to say thank you so much, Eyal Lifshitz, co-founder, general managing partner, storyteller extraordinaire of Peregrine Ventures. Thank you so much for your time here today. Thank you for sharing the history of Israel, the startup nation, all your insights on how venture capital works within Israel, and certainly competing on that global stage. It's now time for your board meeting, so I'll let you go. I want to say thank you very much for your time here. This is the MedTech Money podcast series where we demystify raising and investing capital. Thank you, Eyal.
Thank you very much, Giovanni. I really enjoyed it a lot. It was a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.